From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. In our closely divided country, our connection this hour is made in what unites us. Americans say they want less extreme political choices. They want more choices. They want to feel like they can participate in an election even if the main candidates are unpopular. And yet all across this country, ballot initiatives designed to achieve some of those kinds of changes failed this year. I'll quote political reporter Madison Fernandez now in Politico, quote, "Voters in multiple states rejected structural changes to how they vote. More initiatives that could transform how voters vote were on ballots across the country than ever before. Many would have combined two proposals popular with reformers, an open all-party primary that multiple candidates advance out of, and a ranked choice general election, although some put forward just one change. But only one of those ballot initiatives in D.C. was successful. Voters shot down similar efforts in Arizona, Colorado, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, Oregon, and South Dakota. Proponents of all-party primaries and ranked choice voting argue that they are nonpartisan and they benefit all voters, especially independents who otherwise are not able to cast ballots in primary elections. But officials on both sides of the aisle have come out against these proposals, calling them confusing or arguing that it benefits the other party," end quote. So how did ranked choice voting fall out of favor? What about issues like, well, all-party primaries or term limits or other election reforms? People say they want change. They want a better system. What does it look like? One organization hoping to bring about some of those changes and a better system is called Unite New York. And Tim Dunn is the executive director of Unite New York. It's nice to have him with us this hour. Tim, welcome. Thanks for being on the program.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's a lot of reaction to the election, and a lot of folks are certainly interested.
Well, that's it, right? Ranked choice is dead. We should just give up on it. Is that the conclusion?
You know, honestly, after this election, we should probably just stop holding elections, right? I mean, we should just the system's perfect.
Well, so there's a lot of different places to go here. No, we're going to talk ranked choice. We're going to talk term limits. We're going to talk different reforms. But I want you to start by telling people what the mission of Unite New York is.
Absolutely. Appreciate it. Unite New York is a nonprofit, nonpartisan democracy reform organization. We focus solely on New York State. And we work really across three main areas. You know, one, we try to engage and empower voters and educate them and give them information on important policy issues. We work on research and partnerships to find new policy answers to sort of some of these age-old questions. And ultimately, we also are involved in advocacy, going out and going to the legislature and saying, hey, here's some things that we'd like to see changed about our democracy, because we think democracy is a good thing. Most folks agree with that. But, we think more democracy might be better.
Well, so listeners, let me ask you at the start of this hour here, unless listeners, maybe you feel that things are great, the elections have been running very well, that you wouldn't change anything, you're satisfied with candidates, outcomes, et cetera. But if there are changes that you want to see, maybe it is in open primaries, maybe it is in how the candidates are selected, ranked choice voting, other things, term limits, whatever it is, if there's something that drives you nuts, this is a chance for you to tell us about it, because Unite New York's working on a lot of these issues. I'd love to hear from you. It's right. connections@wxxi.org is the email, connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you call from Rochester, 263-9994. Can I start with the question of an open primary system? Can I ask you about that, Tim?
Sure thing.
Because New York, you write that New York is one of only 12 states now with a completely closed primary system. And meanwhile, there are millions of independent voters in this state. You said there's more independent voters by number in this state than there are total voters in 34 other states. And they don't get to vote in the primaries. They don't get to participate until a general election. And I am trying to understand all angles of this. Part of my advantage, mm-hmm. I think, as a host today is I really don't have a strong opinion on this one. I understand the arguments for and against. But, Tim, party leaders will tell you stay out of our primaries. You're not a Democrat or you're not a Republican, and you should not have a say in what the Republican Party or the Democratic Party is doing. If you want to register, register. But if you're not a Democrat, if you're not a Republican, why should you participate in our primary? What's the answer?
So I think it's a great point. And I think, you know, when we're looking at internal party operations, certainly those outside the party shouldn't be able to make those decisions. However, we're talking about a process that is a governmental process, not a political process. When we're holding elections, these are elections that are paid for by all taxpayers. They don't just go to Republicans and say, hey, we need you to pony up to pay for this Republican primary, and vice versa with Democrats. All of our tax dollars go to those elections, to those primary elections. And as you noted, one of only 12 states with a completely closed primary process, those 3.5 million New Yorkers, that's the largest and fastest growing block of voters in the state of New York. That's most young voters. That's a lot of voters of color. These are folks that are being disenfranchised from the process and being shut out completely. And a prime example is if we look at our elections that just took place on a week ago Tuesday, we had great turnout for the presidential election. We had about 64% turnout. But when we look at party primaries, the party primaries that were held just back in June, statewide, we only saw about 15% turnout. That's a tiny fraction of the number of eligible voters making decisions about who's going to be on the ballot. And then when we turn around and look at the outcomes on election day, so few of our elections are competitive. Those primary elections are where the decisions are being made, because we're deciding whom that candidate's going to be through that party primary. And we know in many places, due to voter enrollment, the Democratic primary may determine the November election, or the Republican primary may determine that November election. We had a lot of choices in the past here in New York where you could enroll in a number of different parties. But through state legislative changes, it's now so difficult to be an independent candidate or to be in something other than the Republican or Democratic Party that many, many voters are now disenfranchised and have no voice and no say in those elections.
Well, it's definitely true that if you live in Bath, New York, the Republican primary is the election. And if you live in the city of Rochester, the Democratic primary is the election. That's how it has worked. That point is fair. And the low turnout for primaries, 15%, you said, and I've seen lower on certain years. But I remember an old quote that Professor Larry Lessig used to use in his presentations. Boss Tweed used to say that I don't care who does the voting as long as I do the nominating. And Boss Tweed had a way of knowing that, okay, I'll let you vote in the general election and you'll feel like you're participating. But if you are not involved in picking who the actual candidates are, you don't really have the power. And you seem to be saying, Tim, that most people either don't have power in who does the nominating or don't exercise it.
It's right. It's really a matter of not having a voice. We look at those primary elections that so many New Yorkers are shut out of. That 3.5 million New Yorkers, that's more voters than are currently enrolled in the Republican, Conservative, and Working Families parties combined. And to have them completely shut out of the process, we look at the 2022 election, where we only had a Republican and a Democrat on the ballot for governor. Only the second time in New York State history that transpired. We had a healthy and robust primary on both sides. There were three candidates on the Democratic side, four candidates on the Republican side. Turnout in those primaries, again, 15%. In fact, when you dig into the numbers deeper, 91% of eligible Democrats either stayed home or voted for someone other than Kathy Hochul, and 94% of Republicans either stayed home or voted for someone other than Lee Zeldin. So when that's the sort of participation level that you have in primaries and so few people making those decisions, how can we honestly then turn around to the 3.5 million who are being shut out and say, hey, we know you're paying for this election, but you're not allowed to participate?
Well, Dallas writes to say, I was surprised when I was registered as a conservative and I couldn't vote in a Republican primary. I had to do the walk of shame back to my car. I'm sure a lot of people have experienced that, but can you take me through, Tim, take me through what it would be like if the reforms you want go through? An open primary means anybody votes in any primary. Can you vote in a Democratic primary? Can you vote in a Republican primary? Can you do both? I mean, how would it work?
Well, let's walk through that because there's a couple different approaches that could be taken. And by the way, when I talk about these, there are 38 other states that have some version of open primaries or semi-open primaries, and the approaches can differ. Now, in some places, anyone can vote in any primary. You choose which primary you want to participate in, and whether you're enrolled in that primary, in that party or not, you're able to participate in the primary. In some states, they allow independent voters, unaffiliated voters, to choose which party primary they want to vote in. But what that actually does is acts as a same-day registration approach. That independent voter choosing to vote in, say, the Democratic primary, that automatically changes their registration to Democrat for the next year. And in other places, everyone's able to vote in all primaries. So there's a couple different approaches to be taken. But think about if we weren't to change the level of engagement at all, right? We were to keep that same 15%. We're now 15% of 3.5 million is a lot of new voters now being exposed to the process. But I would reckon to guess that if you were to open that up, you're going to see participation rates well above 15%. New York chronically has some of the lowest turnout and participation rates in the country. And, you know, this more open approach to primaries is done in states as widely different as California and Texas. You know, it's not like this is something that favors one party or the other.
Okay, but again, in the ideal system, people can vote in as many primaries as they want. Is that correct?
No. What we would like to see is, you know, that's what's called a fat primary, where you're able to vote in multiple primaries. What we think would be appropriate and fair is allow people to choose which primary they'd want to vote in. Or we could have nonpartisan primaries. That would be a whole different approach. If we were to have all candidate, all voter primaries, where let's say you have a Republican, a Democrat, a conservative, an independent, and a Working Families Party candidate, five candidates on the ballot, and everybody would have a chance to vote on them. Now you're really getting candidates that are more representative of the enrolled voters' interests. And in some cases, you know, we've got one bill that we've looked at that we think would be pretty good, that would allow a ranked choice system and open primaries where you could essentially have two candidates advancing to the election, to the general election, that might be even of the same party. In places like Rochester, you might have two Democrats on the ballot. In places where I live, like in Saratoga County, you might have two Republicans on the ballot.
Talking to Tim Dunn, Executive Director of Unite New York. Let me grab a phone call from Jeff in Rochester. Hello, Jeff. Go ahead.
Hey, Evan. Thanks for taking my call. Even beyond the primary process, even to get into a primary, I live in Republican territory. Was asked to run as a Democrat for New York State Senate this year. I had 4 weeks to collect 1,000 signatures across five counties, and they were challenged by the Republican Party. I ended up with 995 signatures. So our senator ran unopposed again this year. And that's because it was, you know, even before you get into a primary, you have to get onto the primary ballot. And in New York State, it's just insane.
Who was the senator, Jeff?
Senator Tom O'Mara.
Okay. So hang on the line for a second there. Tim, what would you say to that phone call?
Jeff, you should be on our website signing up right now, because this is one of the things that we've noted as a big, big problem in the state. For the law was changed in 2020 to make it incredibly more difficult for independent candidates to get on the ballot. Even if you're trying to get on as a party candidate, it's very, very difficult. You know, it's not like you're standing on a street corner in Manhattan. New York's a big, diverse state. To go out and gather all those signatures in the windows 42 days for independent candidates, to be on as an independent for the statewide, you have to get 45,000 signatures in 42 days. That's astounding. Now, if you're in New York City, that's a different story. That might be easy to do. But since this law was changed, we have not had a third party candidate or even anyone other than a Republican or Democrat on the ballot in New York for governor or president. And that's unheard of. That's never been the case before. But, you know, the parties that are in power want to be able to control the rules. And, you know, that's what we run into.
Jeff, what is your lesson that you're taking from this? I mean, how discouraged do you feel? Are you motivated to start earlier next time?
Oh, I think motivated to start earlier, you know, assuming that my wife says it's okay to go for this. But, you know, and I did a little research, and New York State is by far the hardest state even to get onto a primary ballot.
Absolutely.
It was So, but I really appreciate what all you're doing, and I voted for a lot of third party candidates in my day, and would love to see third party candidates beyond Democrats or Republicans on ballots.
Jeff, thank you for the phone call, and I want to say, I am pretty clearly on the record that I want to see more Republicans running in urban centers like Rochester. I want to see more Democrats running in rural areas. I think it is healthier when there are more choices on the ballot, even when the voter rolls are heavily tilted. People have got to have some kind of choice, and I respect anyone who's given that a shot. It is not easy. So, Jeff, I appreciate that. Now, Jeff is frustrated that, you know, he feels like it kind of got gamed against him. He fell five signatures short. Gaming the system is one of the arguments that I hear, Tim Dunn, against open primaries. It sounds something like this. Well, if you leave a primary open, just like the Democrats wanted to kind of pick the Trumpier or kind of more out there candidates in the last congressional cycle, 2022, they can pop into that primary. They can try to tilt the balance in whatever direction they think is more to their favor. And you don't get a pure vote. You get a gamed vote. What do you think?
Well, I guess if our system was perfect right now and was free of flaws now, I might give some validity to that argument. But the reality is there's been ample research done in places where there are open primaries. This has almost never been effective. The Rush Limbaugh one time tried to talk about how Hillary Clinton was successful in a primary in Arkansas by using this method. But there's just no research or data to back up those claims. I would say the current system that we have in New York allows for just as much gaming of the system as has been described. You can go and change your enrollment up until mid-February to try to go game the system in a primary. That has already been done, and actually we've seen a lot of examples of that around the state in places where, say, the Working Families Party has a very low number of enrolled voters. We've seen examples of Republicans or conservatives changing their enrollment to Working Families Party to try to game the primary. That's happened in Rensselaer County, in Saratoga County, all over the state. We've seen examples of this. So there's plenty of opportunities to game the system, and there's no evidence really that open primaries have experienced those challenges.
Now, when it comes to the result of open primaries, we're going to get to ranked choice in a second here, among other reforms. Mm-hmm. But one of the claims is open primaries do lead ultimately to less extreme candidates. Do you think that's correct?
I think it does. I think when you have all voters able to have their voices heard, you end up with less extreme candidates, because now candidates can't really try. They're put in a position where it's not to their advantage to throw rocks at people, to be toxic, to call names. It's to their advantage to try to, you know, maybe focus on issues and policy instead of name calling and nastiness. And we've seen far too much of in our politics. And as we saw in this presidential year, just how bad and how toxic that stuff can get when we only look at the world through red or blue. When you have the opportunity to have, when you're seeking everyone's vote, it becomes a much different ballgame.
Why do you think party leaders are so opposed to this kind of a reform then?
Well, look, it's obviously anything that you're going to do that takes power away from the party bosses and puts it in the hands of the people is going to be viewed with suspect. It's going to be viewed with suspicion. But when I look at the results around the state right now, you know, we had nearly a third, to Jeff's point when he called in a moment ago, nearly a third of our legislative races this year were uncontested. I'm sorry, nearly a fourth. It was a third. That's ridiculous. We know competition is healthy. We know that in a democracy, it's important to have choices and allow the majority to speak. And to not even have a choice, it's absolutely toxic to our democracy, and it's not good for. And the other part of it too is, like, are we looking around New York State and saying, while things are so great that we shouldn't even worry about putting competition up, our leaders are doing such a great job that they shouldn't even be questioned? I don't think so.
We're talking to Tim Dunn, Executive Director of Unite New York. By the way, where are you online if you want people to learn more?
Absolutely. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our website is www.uniteny.org. I would encourage you to anyone to go check us out on the website, learn a little bit more, kick our tires on social media, and give us a shout if you have any questions.
All right. Issues like the ones we're talking about, especially with ranked choice voting, we're on ballots in Arizona, Colorado, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, Oregon, South Dakota, D.C. Only one of those efforts in D.C. was successful. So what happened, Tim, in Arizona, Colorado, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, Oregon, and South Dakota? Do you think voters just took a look at things like ranked choice voting or open primaries and thought like, nah, those are bad? Do you think it was a media campaign against it? I mean, what happened?
Well, I think, first of all, I'm not going to hold myself out to be an expert on elections in any of those other states. But I think, you know, there were some victories around the country. The victories that we saw came at a more local level. D.C. was a good example, but this was ranked choice voting and open primaries were also on the ballot in two other cities and were successful. I think running statewide on these issues is really challenging and problematic. Part of it is, I think, really educating and making sure people understand these issues, because as particularly in a presidential year, there is just such a large volume of information thrown at every voter, particularly in swing states. And you look at some of these states are pretty swingy, Nevada, Arizona, Colorado. These were states that were really important in the presidential election. These were states that generally went to the right. I think that, Donald Trump being top of the ballot and some of the questions that he's raised about democracy reform and his supporters questioning that, I think certainly lended to those outcomes. But I'd also look to things like marriage equality. And if you look at 2002, marriage equality was on the ballot in an awful lot of states as a ballot petition or a ballot initiative, and it was roundly and soundly defeated. And now here we are a few years later, and I guess I'm dating myself, it's more 20 years later, and it's kind of the law of the land everywhere. And so I think, this was a moment in time for the reform movement. I don't know that I would necessarily call it a trend, but I definitely think that there are learnings from it about education, about messaging, about targets and where you want to go with this, and probably more of a reason to focus on grassroots ground game than shooting for statewide opportunities.
Well, Tim, here's the chance to explain to listeners who kept hearing about ranked choice voting, maybe heard it here and there, and then they see a couple of these headlines from the last couple of weeks that say ranked choice voting is dead, bad night for ranked choice voting. Explain how it would work in this state and why it would benefit voters, in your opinion.
So ranked choice voting on its own isn't a panacea, but when coupled with some other changes, really presents big opportunities for voters to be more empowered. And if you look at combining ranked choice voting with open primaries where all voters are able to participate, or with making it easier to get on the ballot. As we talked about earlier, it's really hard to get on the ballot here in New York. With ranked choice voting, in our current system, you have the Democrats pick their candidate, the Republicans pick their candidate, and it's about lunchtime. We can talk about food. If the Republicans are shopping for their candidate at a diner and the Democrats are shopping for their candidate at a Mexican restaurant, they may be considering it the diner meatloaf, a Reuben sandwich or liver and onions, right? And the Republicans all come together and decide they want liver and onions for lunch. Well, the Democrats put their heads together and they're deciding between tacos, burritos, and enchiladas, and they decide enchiladas are their choice. Now, us as voters just have to choose between enchiladas and liver and onions. Now, I like enchiladas. I don't really like liver and onions, but if instead we were able to have all those choices on the ballot and let voters rank them in order to be like, listen, I love enchiladas. I love tacos. I like meatloaf. I like Reubens. I can't stand liver and onions. I go ahead and I rank those choices in order. And liver and onions at the bottom, once all votes are cast, we have an instant runoff where the least popular option is eliminated. The lowest vote getter gets eliminated. So in this case, hopefully liver and onions gets thrown out. Whereas in our traditional system, it's one of only two choices. So you have an opportunity to maybe, if you don't get your first choice, you may very well have a viable option that you'd like, that you could tolerate eating as your second choice. And that's simply done through, if no candidate gets more than 50% of the votes, the lowest vote getter is eliminated. And then all the votes are tabulated based on that. It's been used in New York City quite effectively in 2021, and ultimately gave us a winner that had more than 50% support when all votes were counted.
This is how The Hill described the opposition to ranked choice voting in 2022. So this comes from an analysis from The Hill. Quote, the popularity of ranked choice voting stems from the fact that it permits candidates with extreme political views and narrow bases of support to run in elections without acting as a spoiler for one of the major party candidates. For example, in the 2000 presidential election, Democrat Al Gore lost to Republican George W. Bush in Florida by a smaller margin than the total number of voters who voted for Green Party candidate Ralph Nader. However, ranked choice voting makes it more difficult to elect moderate candidates when the electorate is polarized. For example, in a three-person race, the moderate candidate may be preferred to each of the more extreme candidates by a majority of voters. However, voters with far left and far right views will rank the candidate in second place rather than in first place. Since ranked choice voting counts only the number of first choice votes among the remaining candidates, the moderate candidate would be eliminated in the first round, leaving one of the extreme candidates to be declared the winner, end quote. Is that a fair reading of it, Tim?
That may be a fair reading of the article, but I'm not sure where The Hill did their research on that, because where ranked choice voting has been implemented in the United States, research has shown it results in more moderate candidates being successful. It has shown that more diverse candidates are successful. It has shown that it empowers more female candidates, because you don't have a single lane of, well, this is the Black candidate, this is the Hispanic candidate, this is the female candidate. You have more choices. And ultimately, the candidates, again, aren't have an advantage by being toxic and attacking, because they're competing not just for first place votes, they're competing for second place votes. So the data that has been done and the research that's been done on this shows just the opposite of that Hill analysis. And I think maybe if they were to go back and update that article and look at some of these firsthand data analysis that's been done by researchers around the country, they would probably come up with a different outcome.
All right, before we get to term limits, and we'll take a phone call in a second on that, what do you think is likely to happen with issues like ranked choice and open primaries? How much momentum do you actually feel for those in this state?
Well, I'll tell you, as we go into 2025, we've heard firsthand from legislators that they think that democracy is going to be an issue that's on the ballot. Democracy is going to be, we heard a lot of that in this presidential election, and I think there's going to be a real interest from the legislature to take up some of these issues. Where we sit, the most important thing that we're trying to convey to legislators is our big three issues that we're really going to lean into legislatively this year: term limits, open primaries, and citizen ballot initiatives. Those issues all enjoy widespread support. Term limits right now, and we've pulled this on a quarterly basis, and term limits right now and consistently has been supported by more than 70% of New Yorkers. 70% of New Yorkers think we need to have term limits for the state legislature and for the governor's office. Citizen ballot initiatives, being able to get an issue directly on the ballot as a citizen and not having to rely on the legislature to put it there. We just saw this with the Equal Rights Amendment that was on the ballot on Election Day. That's supported by, again, 71% of New York voters. And open primaries enjoys more than 60% support from New York voters. So New Yorkers are saying loud and clear to the legislature what they want and what they value and what they'd like to see happen. I think now it's up to the legislature to decide, hey, did we hear a mandate for change from our voters in this election? And I would say, gosh, if there's a change agent, his name is Donald Trump. And in New York, he only lost the vote by 11%, which is an astonishing margin when you think about there are 6 million Democrats and only 2.9 million Republicans enrolled in this state. I think there's a big opportunity for the majorities in both houses to really embrace these reforms that are wildly popular with the public.
Let me take a phone call from if I ever say the word term limit on these airwaves, it's like putting a bat signal out, and Mark Johns is going to give me a call. Mark is a Monroe County legislator. He's a former New York State legislator. Term limits is an important issue to Mark, who is on the line with us now. It's always nice to hear from you, Mark. Go ahead.
Well, gentlemen, I didn't hear the beginning, so I didn't know you were talking about term limits. But I always say if you're not a TLC, that's a term limits candidate. If you're not a TLC, you're not for me. You're only for yourself and getting reelected. I even got the new website, votetlc.com, because it's a movement. When you say 75% or whatever, it's way higher than that. They put term limits on the ballot in New York City decades ago, got 77% of the vote. In a, what, 3-1, 4-1 New York City. Out in Long Island on Suffolk County, they put a ballot initiative for Suffolk County, term limits on Suffolk County legislature. This was in 2021, got 86% of the vote. And if these guys, if these men and women down in Albany or Washington, they want to put term limits on Supreme Court judges, which is Pat Buchanan's old idea, well, good. I mean, let's start there, but let's make sure that we also do it with Congress. And I don't want to listen to all these phonies flip-flopping around as to why they're needed. Oh, I suddenly got here and found out I'm very valuable. No, you're not. We have less diversity in New York State than any other state. I mean, New York State is the most one-sided, lopsided voting state in the country. You know that out in California, they have term limits. They have a ballot initiative. And let me just leave you with one thing. I had the SOL Act, which, you know, what I called S-O-L-E, single opportunity to legislate equally, which only meant that any legislator could bring up one piece of legislation, have a vote on it. They're afraid the term limits is coming up, and when they vote no, they'll be kicked out of office. The second bill I had was the FDR bill. Now, I figured, how could Democrats vote against FDR? But it stood for the Fairness and Democratic Reform Act. And what it said was it was ballot initiative. It said that the public could go out there and take any of our state, you know, go to bill drafting, see all our bills, 90% of them are never voted on. So look at any bill in the state legislature, which has been drafted by experts, and get 50,000 votes statewide. And whatever the most popular vote that, popular bill that they didn't vote on, put it on the ballot for the public to flip the ballot over and vote on the other side. They don't want democracy. They want to stay in power, and the big money and the big lobbyists want to stay in, having to stay in power. Like I always say, they want rich career politicians that are bought and paid for to stay bought and paid for.
Mark Johns, nice to hear from you, sir. Tim Dunn, what do you think?
Do we want to turn the rest of the show over to Mark? And I can kick back on this.
Mark could host this show.
Well, what he's saying is music to my ears. You're absolutely correct that this term limits is the most overwhelmingly positive and well supported popular reform out there. And I think it's simple. And Mark did a great job really extolling the virtues. But it's simple. This country was not founded around the concept of career politicians. It was founded around the concept of the farmer, the businessman, the lawyer, the father, the mother, taking time away to go serve their community and then returning to their home. And you know, when we look at nearly 3/4 of the states in the country have term limits, when we look at how many cities and counties in our state have term limits, the sky hasn't fallen. There's no incredible knowledge that's vested in someone after their 8th term in office that is not there for someone coming in new. And I think, you know, I sometimes jokingly say that, you know, term limits and politicians and diapers should be changed often and for the same reason. But, you know, the reality is we have moved to this system of a career platform. As we've talked to legislators on about term limits, you know, what's really sad, one of the major objections is, well, what about my pension? You shouldn't be running for office to get a pension.
Yeah.
We have folks in the state legislature right now that have been in the state legislature for more than 40 years. Evan, I'm 45 years old. There are people that have been in office as long as I have been on this planet. That there is absolutely no reason for that. The general manager of the Green Bay Packers, it is written into the Green Bay Packers bylaws that the general manager of the Green Bay Packers has to retire at 70 years old. What sort of incredible knowledge do our legislators have, do our governors have, do our elected officials have, that's not imparted on the Green Bay Packers general manager? Our Supreme Court justices in New York State are required to retire at 70 years old, yet none of our other elected officials are. We just saw an election here in the presidential where the incumbent Democratic president was essentially forced out of office because he showed that he was not really at his age capable of doing the job. And his own party chased him off the ballot. Now, maybe we need to wait for George Clooney to write an op-ed for term limits in New York State. Or maybe I just need to go get some coffee from Mark Johns and let him do the job for me.
Well, listen, in a moment, I'm going to try to poke some holes in the term limit, and we'll see how Tim does with a little pushback. But before we get there, let me just say that I take the point that this country was not founded on the idea of a bunch of people who are career politicians who never leave. This country was founded with the idea that civil servants do matter. They should be not necessarily partisan, and they can stay. And typically that's what we've seen, especially in Washington. Civil servants serve, you know, in George W. Bush's administration and Barack Obama's administration and Donald Trump's and Joe Biden's. But now you've got people like Vivek Ramaswamy and others saying they're just going to wipe out a bunch of civil servants. We are seeing people leave voluntarily because they feel that it is being politicized. So what you have are people like Donald Trump joking that maybe he'll be president again in 2028. Maybe he'll run again. Whereas civil servants who are supposed to not be all that partisan are the ones who are leaving. And it feels a little backwards to me, Tim.
I agree with you. You need nonpartisan professionals in government, just like you need in any other profession. But it's downright un-American and undemocratic for folks to be in office for 40 and 50 years. And when we have that sort of a system, you look around what happened in our elections on November 5th. If you look at the outcomes of many of these races, you have an average margin of victory across the state in the neighborhood of 30 or 40% because of all the unopposed races. Because, as we heard earlier, it's so hard to get on the ballot and someone's guaranteed reelection once they're in office and they start feeding the cycle. We saw in the case of in my state senator's case, Jim Todisco, nice guy. I like him personally. He's literally been in office between the state assembly and the state senate for 40 years. I mean, you don't want a CEO serving that long. Why do we have our elected officials serving that long?
Okay, so now let me try to push back against the idea of term limits. First of all, here's an email from David listening in Ovid, who says term limits in Congress would leave lobbyists with the institutional memory. Term limits exist. They are called elections. That's from David in Ovid. So, hey, he's saying voters can decide. They could term limit somebody out as quick as they want.
Sure. And I've heard that quote even from the Speaker of the State Assembly, that elections are term limits. But the reality is, when districts are drawn in such a manner that they guarantee a certain outcome, I looked at the outcome from our elections, and we have assembly districts ranging in size of enrolled voters as wide as 53,000 at the low end to 135,000 at the high end. These districts are drawn specifically to favor and cater to one candidate, one party, or another. And then, once in office, electeds have essentially an endless supply of franking abilities to send mailers out to their constituents and constantly have their name and record in front of constituents, whereas, you know, competition doesn't have that opportunity. Then we hear how hard it is for a candidate to get on the ballot. And then if you even try to, the opposing party will try to knock you off with exceptions and loopholes. So, if our system was fair on its face value, then I would agree with that statement that elections are term limits. But if that were the case, then why are so many communities in our state? Why does the city of Syracuse have term limits? Why does New York City have term limits? Why do counties and cities all over the state have term limits if our system is fair and elections serve that purpose? I think there's some great opportunities there for reform. And, you know, fresh blood and new ideas are always a good thing.
What about the institutional knowledge, though? David's point from Ovid is if lobbyists are the only ones with institutional knowledge, we're in trouble.
Well, I agree with that statement. But I mean, if that's the case, then we really don't trust our elected officials and we're putting the wrong people into office. I remember a few years ago when the state senator who was the chair of the Senate Health Committee, as a big surprise, you know, lost in an upset. He was a guy out on Long Island and lost to a Democrat and wasn't expected. And the Senate had to scramble to find who in the state Senate has any knowledge about healthcare. Well, shouldn't we not have to rely on one person to know health policy? That's the wrong approach to, you know, for health policy for 15 million people. That's not the right how we should be approaching this important issue. We're going to have staff that understand these issues. And ultimately, if you think that lobbyists aren't calling the shots on a lot of this stuff already, then gosh, I'd love to sell you a bridge in Brooklyn.
And an email from Sarah says, Evan, I'm originally from Virginia. And in Virginia, we have a law forbidding the governor from running for reelection. The governor should have one chance to get reelected, then voters can be the term limit. So a similar sentiment from Sarah, but she's saying that you can go too far here, that a one-term term limit she thinks is too much because at least a chance to run for reelection is a firm chance for the electorate to say whether they approve of the direction you've taken your state. So what do you make of places like Virginia where the term is one term only for governor?
I think that's really hard, and particularly in a state like New York, where it's such a large and diverse and complex state, one term is just nowhere near enough. We were supporting legislation in the last session that would have enacted a three-term limit on our statewide elected officials, and this would have been a prospective move, wouldn't have hurt anyone currently in office. But if you look historically, that's where our longer serving governors run into challenges, run into headwinds, is that third term. I mean, Andrew Cuomo is a perfect example. Look at all the problems he ran into in his third term, you know, allegations and really terrible conduct, because I think he got a little too cushy, a little too comfortable in office. And we saw that we've seen that in a number of other places. Look, the president has limited to two terms. Why is the governor of New York State able to serve, you know, in perpetuity?
Talking to Tim Dunn, the executive director of Unite New York. So same question on this particular issue. Is there any momentum and are the party leaders going to block term limits?
We were really excited to advance legislation this past session on it. We actually a wonderful leader out of Western New York, Monica Wallace, sponsored legislation to advance this. Unfortunately, and we went out and were able to gather a whole bunch of co-sponsors on this legislation to implement a three-term limit on our statewide elected officials. Unfortunately for us, Assemblymember Wallace lost a pretty close election a few weeks ago, so she'll not be returning. So we are looking for sponsors. So if you know Mark Johns and his friends and neighbors in the Rochester area want you know one of their incredible leaders in the state assembly or senate to introduce term limits legislation, call them. Give a shout to your state senator, to your state assembly member, and say we need term limits right now, and go pick up Monica Wallace's bill and run with it.
All right, so the three big priorities for Unite New York: term limits, open primaries, and citizen ballot initiatives. Tell us about the third.
Citizen ballot initiatives, as we heard from some folks earlier, you know, it's an opportunity for the average citizen to circulate a petition and get an issue onto the ballot for voters to consider. In New York State currently, the only way for there to be a ballot initiative is for the legislature to advance it. Now, we have the ability at the city level in New York State for average citizens to go out and effectuate change to the charter of the city, and which would gives a whole slate of opportunities for citizen ballot initiatives. At the local level, nearly every decision of a local government is subject to permissive referendum. If I don't like that my town spent $2 million on a new playground and I don't think we have the money for it, I can go gather signatures from my neighbors and compel the local government to put that up for a vote of the people. dozens and dozens of states have a citizen ballot initiative process. It's kind of similar to our thinking with term limits is, you know, if you can't trust the voters to make good decisions here, then our democracy has already failed. You know, we also see where issues have been successful on citizen ballot initiatives across the country on issues as wide ranging as gun rights and women's health. And now, as we just talked about, a lot of the ballot initiatives around the country on ranked choice voting were unsuccessful this year. We're not saying let's get citizen ballot initiatives because we want to see something else. There's no dark horse, you know, stalking there that we want to see come in. We just think we should trust our voters to be able to make good decisions. And particularly, as Legislator Johns mentioned earlier, if so many bills bottled up that can't find their way to the floor of the state legislature, we said, how about this? How about if we go out and gather signatures from 1% of the voters in the state, 1% of the voters that voted in the last election, that'd be 60,000 signatures. That's not an easy thing to do. That's a lot of signatures. We're proposing you go out and get those 60,000 signatures, and that would compel the legislature to take a vote on this issue, regardless of what the issue is. They can, you know, vote yes and put it on the ballot in November for voters to decide, or they can vote no. And if they vote no, why not then allow citizens to go out and do another round of petitions and compel it to be put on the ballot? That's what's done at the city level right now. And the sky hasn't fallen. This has been used in places around the state. And we think ultimately that's a form of direct democracy that our voters understand and like. It also can help legislators to that they might not know how important an issue is to voters. They might underestimate that. And when they go out and see that, you know, 20,000 voters in their district signed a petition to implement X, now they know, and that's probably going to inform their vote.
Well, before we close here, Gallup did some polling just a month ago on other election law policies that Americans favor or oppose. And I'm going to run down the list here of what Americans favor, and I want to get your take on these. Mm-hmm. 84% polled by Gallup favor requiring all voters to provide photo ID at their voting place. 83% require people who are registering to vote for the first time to provide proof of citizenship. 76% favor early voting, which gives voters the chance to cast a ballot before Election Day itself. 60% favor enacting automatic voter registration, whereby citizens are automatically registered to vote when they do business with the DMV or other state agencies. 60% favor sending absentee ballot applications to all eligible voters prior to an election. Those five got strong majority support, starting with photo ID, voter ID. What do you make of that?
Well, it's, you know, it's certainly, we've heard those issues too, and we've heard from voters, a lot on that. You know, what our reforms have really focused on is trying to fix some serious problems that we've identified. In New York State, I have not heard major issues with people fraudulently trying to vote as someone else. You do have to present a picture ID to register to vote. That has to be done. You have to present that the first time, and then they check your signature, which is now through a software system. So I don't know how much of an impact a photo ID requirement would have. I don't know that there's a big problem looking to be solved there. Perhaps there is, and I'd love to hear more about it. But we try to focus on the forms.
You're right. I don't have any evidence of that either. But go ahead.
Yeah. Proof of citizenship. Similarly, yeah. I certainly you should be a citizen to vote, and in this country, it's a requirement to be a citizen to vote. And again, I think you have to prove that to even register to vote. So unless we think that there is massive fraud taking place, and we have a lot of folks duping our elections inspectors, again, I'm not sure what problem that solves. Early voting, we have early voting in this state, so that's kind of a moot point. The automatic voter registration, was that the fourth one?
Yep, automatic voter registration, 60% say yes.
Well, I mean, that would be a great way to further disenfranchise a whole bunch of voters, because we would grow that 3.5 million that can't vote in primaries even larger, because if you register people and they don't even know they're getting registered, I don't think you're going to have the most active voters. So again, I'm not sure what a problem that would solve. And then the absentee to all voters, from a pure amount of paper standpoint, I'm not sure that's a great idea. We try to look at all of these reforms as first and foremost, what's the problem that we're trying to solve?
Yeah.
And from where we sit, we think that not enough voters are engaged. Not enough voters think that their voice matters. Not enough voters are feeling like this system works for them. So the reforms that we support are really trying to focus on that. How do we get more people involved in the process? How do we get people to feel like their voice matters again? How do we get closer to a more representative democracy? Because our polling is showing 55% of New Yorkers think the state is on the wrong track. And only 12% of voters think that New York is ahead of the curve when it comes to election reform. So clearly, the way that we're doing things, the way we're doing business here in New York with elections, it's not working for the average voter. I would challenge anyone that thinks New York is in a great place right now. And I'm not pointing fingers at anyone in particular. We're nonpartisan. We're looking to just see how do we get more voters involved, regardless of their political stripe.
And as we close here, that is one of the big keys here, Tim. You seem to be saying that if these reforms happened, more people would be glad to participate in democracy. Yes?
I think so. We think that if we currently have laws in place that make New York one of the easiest states in the nation to register to vote, to participate in an election, but yet we're still seeing numbers that we don't think are acceptable in terms of engagement. So we got to do better.
I want to thank you, Tim, for grappling with our listeners, for engaging on these subjects, and I hope that you'll come back sometime.
Evan, I would love to come back anytime. Next time, we'll have to do it in person so I get a garbage plate.
There we go. Tim Dunn, the executive director of Unite New York. Tim, tell people where to find you online.
We're at www.uniteny.org or Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
That's Tim Dunn. Listeners, thanks for a very spirited 2 hours. And from all of us at Connections, thank you for listening. We are back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.